From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The afternoon when the World Trade Center came down that Tuesday, and then every day after that, people would ask, you know, is it safe to be here? Is the air? And they would assure us. People would come around and say, oh, yeah, the EPA's been here. It's absolutely safe. We took them at their word. As a result of that, now we've had a couple hundred guys that have gone out of the fire department with lung problems and heart problems. It's a direct result of that.
The White House lied to New York. It told the EPA not to properly inform New Yorkers about air quality after 9/11. The man in charge of environmental quality at the White House, James Connaughton, an industry lawyer who used to represent major asbestos polluters. We'll talk with Congressmember Gerald Nadler, Juan Gonzalez, author of Fallout, and a firefighter. Then a suit in Alabama against the removal of the Ten Commandments monument. We'll have a debate. And we'll look at the California recall vote and Arnold Schwarzenegger. Stay with us. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, as many U.S. soldiers have now died after May 1st, when President Bush declared major combat operations over as before. A total of 276 U.S. soldiers have been killed, 138 before and after. Congressional investigators are accusing Vice President Dick Cheney of stymieing their investigation into his energy task force by withholding key documents that detailed which corporations helped write the administration's energy policy. Without the records, the General Accounting Office reports the public may never know the extent that the nation's energy policy was shaped by oil, coal, nuclear, chemical, and natural gas companies. Among the industry executives who met privately with Cheney and aides was Kenneth Lay, the former chair of Enron. Among other things, the Cheney-led task force claims it cannot provide a budget of money spent or of notes from any of the 10 cabinet-level meetings it held in 2001. Michigan Congressmember John Dingell, a Democrat, said, quote, "This report is a sad chronicle of the efforts of the office of the vice president to hide its activities from the American people." The Washington Post reports the Bush administration yesterday launched a public relations campaign to counter the growing criticism of the administration's handling of the Iraq occupation. Both Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice addressed the 104th Veterans of Foreign Wars National Convention. Rice highlighted what she saw as successes in Iraq, as well as in the Israel-Palestine peace talks. It was at the 103rd VFW meeting that Vice President Cheney spoke a year ago, kickstarting the administration's push for war. At the time, Cheney said, quote, "Simply stated, there is no doubt Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction. There is no doubt he is amassing them to use against our friends, our allies, and against us." Nearly 2 years after Saudi hijackers led attacks in the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, Saudi Arabia has agreed to set up a joint task force with the United States to target suspected members of Al-Qaeda in the kingdom. Agents from the FBI, the Treasury Department, and the Internal Revenue Service will soon be stationed in Saudi Arabia. One of the top State Department experts in North Korea has resigned just days before the U.S. is set to enter nuclear talks with North Korea and four other nations. The diplomat, Jack Pritchard, was seen as one of the administration's few moderates on North Korea and has long backed giving North Korea incentives for complying with international demands. Agence France-Presse is reporting the death toll from yesterday's car bombings in Bombay has reached at least 52 people. No group has taken responsibility. Indian officials blame Muslim militants. One of the bombs went off near a Hindu temple in the old city. Fox News Channel has dropped its lawsuit against humorist Al Franken. A federal judge Friday refused the request of Fox to block publication of Franken's book titled Lies and the Lying Liars That Tell Them, A Fair and Balanced Look at the Right. Fox claimed the phrase fair and balanced could not be used because Fox had copyrighted it in 1995. And this news from St. Louis, a man who spent 17 years in prison was released yesterday after DNA tests proved he was innocent. Lonnie Irby had been sentenced to 115 years in prison for committing three rapes. Irby said after being released, quote, I've got dreams, you know. I want to go places and do things that I never got the chance to do. So much trouble in the world. Bob Marley here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Environmental Protection Agency report was released on Friday, revealing that the National Security Council pressured EPA officials to downplay the health hazards caused by the collapse of the World Trade Center. The public was lied to about the extensive presence of asbestos from the two buildings, toxic dioxins that were floating in the downtown air, increased amounts of lead found in the atmosphere. The report reveals that the trail of public misinformation began in the White House. For example, one statement from the initial draft said that asbestos levels in some areas were three times higher than national standards. This was changed to say, quote, slightly above the 1% trigger for defining asbestos material. In another case, despite warnings by EPA scientists, a sentence was added to a September 16th news release concluding, quote, our tests show it's safe for New Yorkers to go back to work in New York's financial district. In a statement which raised concerns about sensitive populations such as asthma patients, the elderly, and people with underlying respiratory diseases was deleted. Well, in today's New York Daily News, Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez writes that the man in charge of the environmental quality at the White House is James Connaughton, who'd been on the job for 3 months, was an industry lawyer who represented major asbestos and toxic polluters before his appointment by President Bush. Juan joins us on the line right now. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Juan.
Good day, Amy.
Can you talk more about what you found after you've read this, more than 160-page report, and specifically start with James Connaughton?
Yeah, well, Connaughton, before he was appointed in June of 2001 by President Bush, worked as a lawyer representing firms like Asarco, Asarco Incorporated, which has more than 1,000 asbestos liability suits against it, and represented other companies, General Electric and others, who in the past have had major problems with pollution. And so it's astounding that this man, who was made a living representing polluters, especially asbestos polluting companies, now suddenly was a guy who told the EPA directly to change language about in relation to asbestos particularly. For instance, there was the original draft of a September 13th EPA press release, which was one of the first press releases EPA put out, said, quote, even at low levels, EPA considers asbestos hazardous in this situation. That was changed by the White House to say, quote, short-term, low-level exposure to asbestos of the type that might have been produced by the collapse of the World Trade Center buildings is unlikely to cause significant health effects. It's basically turning the statement upside down. So it's particularly chilling to find out that the guy who was in charge at the White House of environmental quality policy was ordering the scientists and the health officials to change material in these releases.
We're also joined on the line by Jack Ginty, the Uniform Fire Officers Association. You survived the World Trade Center collapse. Can you talk about what you're calling for firefighters here in New York? More than 300 were killed.
Yeah, 343 of our people were killed that day. And, you know, what we're calling for is just for them to come out with the truth. I mean, anybody that was there that day, and I was there 5 minutes after the first plane struck, and I was there when the second plane struck, and I stayed there from that Tuesday till a Saturday, and it was obvious to anybody walking around that there was not just a stench, that the air was polluted. And from the afternoon, it was Tuesday, September 11th, when the planes hit, and even that afternoon when we went back, as we called it, the pile, to try to recover people, it was asked many times, is it safe here? And we were told by city officials and, I guess, federal officials, oh, yeah, we've tested the air is fine. And this isn't the first time that this kind of situation happened. Back in around 1974, 75, they had the New York City telephone fire, and the same thing, heavy smoke condition, you know, and as it turned out, with the burning insulation and the covering on the wires was PVCs, that polyvinyl chloride. And, again, we were assured at that one that, no problem. And then since then, hundreds of firemen have died as a result of that New York City fire, telephone fire. So we're in the same situation here. Here we are, you know, a year down the road, 2 years down the road, 3 years, and now finally the truth comes out that they've been lying to us all the way along. In fact, there's a bill right now in Albany that passed both the Senate and the Assembly in New York without any negative comment, to allow anybody that worked at the World Trade Center, that if should they retire or should they come back down at a later date with either cancer or anything that would be related there, they could then go back and get a disability pension. Now, it's passed both houses, and it's on the desk of the governor. Now we got to see if he'll sign that. So it doesn't surprise me or anybody that was down there that we were lied to. It was obvious that first day that there was numerous pollutants in the air. And had we known, we could have operated in a different fashion. I wouldn't say on the first day, because when it came down, we just went down there to see if we could recover anybody we could. But by later on that night, we realized we weren't in a rescue mode. We were in a recovery mode. And we could have done that better.
Jack Ginty, the mayor, Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, said he trusts President Bush.
Well, I would hope that it never even got to his level when they say the White House. You know, it almost shakes your trust in the country when you think that a president would do that. I would just hope it was a lower functionary that he did it, that somebody, you know, eight levels below him just changed it without him seeing it. Because he was there. I was there when he came, and he was with us, all the firemen, saying that he was going to get the people that did it, and he'd make sure he'd take care of us. And now to find out, you know, this at a later date like this, that they were lying to us, it's very discouraging.
Well, Juan Gonzalez, what about this evidence that it goes right to the White House and how high up it goes?
Well, I think that one of the interesting things about this, and I think for this you can definitely blame the president, is that Connaughton and the people from the Council on Environmental Quality refused a request by the EPA Inspector General to be interviewed on their role or on, you know, who gave them who gave them the orders to do what they did. So at this point, the White House is refusing to cooperate, or has refused to cooperate, with the Inspector General's office, and the Inspector General made that clear in the report. I think it would be very easy for President Bush to tell his staff members, listen, cooperate with this investigation. I want to get to the bottom of what happened. So far, that hasn't happened. I think also the most important thing, I think, out of the report that has not gotten a lot of attention is that the IG's office also looked at the current cleanup that the EPA finally, after months and months of criticism and public outcry, finally agreed that it was going to do a cleanup of Lower Manhattan, but decided only to do residential apartments and only those that where people requested them. The Inspector General's report says quite clearly that this cleanup is inadequate, that the only way that a real cleanup of downtown Manhattan can happen is, number one, is if buildings are cleaned up as systems, because if you have a central air conditioning system, HVAC system, and three or four apartments in the building want to be cleaned up, but the whole building is not cleaned up, then pollution can travel through the HVAC system back into apartments that have been cleaned. So the IG is recommending that buildings be cleaned all together, all at once. And also, the Inspector General is saying that the commercial office buildings have to be cleaned, not just the residential buildings. And EPA's response to that is that that's going to cost a lot of money. So the Inspector General reminds EPA in his rebuttal, or her rebuttal, that President Bush and Christie Todd Whitman originally said that no expense would be spared to assure the health of the people of Lower Manhattan. So I think that is the battle that still is being waged by people like Congressman Jerry Nadler and Senator Hillary Clinton. I think they're going to have a press conference today about it, that the full cleanup of Lower Manhattan still has to be completed, because if there were pollutants, and there were, that made their way into buildings that have not been properly cleaned, then that pollution and those toxic chemicals are still there circulating in the air.
Juan, you had trouble even getting it into your own paper, the exposés that you were doing before anyone else on the environmental quality down at the World Trade Center, New York Daily News.
Well, not initially getting it into the paper. I think I was originally had to quite a bit of support getting it into the paper. But once, on October 26th, I had a front page piece revealing all of the various toxic chemicals that EPA had not yet made clear were being emitted from the fires and in and around Ground Zero. There was quite a bit of pressure on the newspaper, all the way from the EPA and the mayor's office and everyone else, that this was irresponsible reporting, that it was going to damage the reconstruction effort, and there was that, you know, at that point there was some let's say more careful checking of my stories that went on, but I think that overall, you know, the large part of my stories on this issue did get into the paper, and I think that it's clear the Inspector General even remarked that public opinion polls showed that 70% of the people in New York did not believe the EPA when it said that the air was safe, and concluded that it will be years before we really know if the air at Ground Zero was safe, because of the enormous quantities of different toxic chemicals that were released at the site, and the combination of them. No one really knows the impact, synergistic effect of people being exposed to so many toxics, either in a huge blast in those first that first day, those people who were caught up in the dust cloud, or in a short-term, you know, 4 months combination of all these different chemicals.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Juan Gonzalez, co-host Democracy Now! And reporter with the New York Daily News, and Jack Ginty, Uniformed Fire Officers Association. We'd hope to be joined by Congressmember Nadler. Maybe he's preparing for his press conference with Hillary Clinton, or being out with Howard Dean tonight at Bryant Park outside the New York Public Library here in New York City. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, a debate on the Bush administration's exemption of thousands of industrial plants and refineries from the Clean Air Act. Stay with us.
Could you see her flying straight through space and time, leaving all humankind behind? If she could fly away, if she could fly away, so far away. If the earth could run away, could you see her gathering all the trees and plants, all the animals, all the birds and fowl, every creeping thing? They have never been her foe, never harmed her blessed soul. If she could ride away, if she could ride away, so far away, then she'd be running for life.
Battered Earth, Sweet Honey in the Rock, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. New regulation that is being promulgated by the Bush administration exempts thousands of industrial plants and refineries from the Clean Air Act. The Bush administration settled on the rule after more than 2 years of internal deliberation and intense pressure from the industry. A new rule constitutes a sweeping and cost-saving victory for industrial plants. It allows older power plants, oil refineries, and industrial units to renovate and upgrade their equipment without installing air pollution controls. Plants can engage in routine maintenance without having to install cleaner technologies. The exemption translates into billions of dollars in savings for industrial plants, even if they increase the amount of pollutants they emit. Activists from the Clean Air Task Force predict the enforcement of these changes will yield greater pollution and negative health effects, including 20,000 additional premature births, 400,000 additional asthma attacks, and 12,000 additional cases of chronic bronchitis. Over 300 nonprofit environmental and public health organizations from 47 different states are expressing concern over the proposed changes. To debate this issue, we're joined by Scott Siegel, director of the Electrical Reliability Coordinating Council, which represents utilities in this country, and John Walk, director of the Natural Resources Defense Council. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Why don't we begin with John Walk? What's your problem with this exemption?
Well, the Bush administration is about to eliminate clean air protections that would be the worst pollution and enforcement scandal ever to rock EPA. These protections apply to over 17,000 industrial polluters around the country. And as we saw in the previous segment, pollution, fraud, and deception have now become weekly events at EPA. This rule has no defensible basis under the law for purposes of air quality protection, and it's really just a giveaway to big polluters like those represented by Mr. Siegel.
Scott Siegel, your response.
Well, as always, a nice measured discussion of the issue. First of all, if there's any fraud that goes on in this country about environmental protection, it has to do with the fact that when environmental programs become too inflexible, they can actually discourage pollution prevention activities, increases in energy efficiency, which are the best way to prevent pollution, and can discourage reliability of the electric power grid, which I think the folks of the East Coast only too recently got a taste of. The bottom line is that air quality in the United States is getting much cleaner, and these are trends that date back to even a time when John was uncomfortable with the way the NSR program was being enforced, before the great New Source Review 1999 enforcement initiative. The bottom line is that there is ample justification on environmental grounds to make this program more flexible and more rational. And that's why attorneys general organizations, that's why state organizations, that's why Harvard University experts, experts from Resources for the Future, on down the list, the National Association of African American Chambers of Commerce, on down the list, have supported pragmatic reform of the New Source Review program. That's what we're getting here, a results orientation, and all the scare tactic and scare rhetoric will not change the fact that improved efficiency is the best way to prevent pollution in the United States.
So you're getting what you want?
Yes. And you should want to.
John Walk, your response.
Well, let me just get a couple of things right out there up front. Not a single one of the organizations that Scott just mentioned has supported these rollbacks of the Clean Air Act, and he knows it. And let's just address another flat-out deception head-on. The blackouts of several weeks ago are not linked in one way at all to these clean air rules. Scott well knows that the problems have been linked to transmission lines and the grid itself, which are not regulated by this clean air program. So this is just, deception and misleading diversion on his part. The truth is that the Bush administration is adopting a combination of an Enron accounting fraud scheme to make cost to industry the sole criterion to determine how much pollution they can create. My organization has analyzed this rule. We obtained a leaked copy of the rule, as reported in the New York Times, and it would allow hundreds of thousands of tons of illegal pollution from just several plants that we looked at, and I believe, without a doubt, millions of tons of illegal pollution nationwide. The thing to understand about this program, as you listen to Scott, is it only applies when polluters increase their pollution. There is only the need for the loophole the Bush administration is adopting when they increase their pollution. If they are decreasing their pollution, as Scott has argued, they will not be covered by this program. So whenever you hear him use the terms efficiency and reliability and all other things that sound nice, he is using those terms as code for pollution increases, and that is what the Bush administration is allowing his clients to avoid cleaning up.
Well, I've got to address that's a fundamental misconception. First of all, one person's increase is another person's decrease, and John's group has become incredibly
Did
adept
you just say that,
at
Scott?
filing litigation, which does nothing but delay improvements in pollution prevention projects, to describe what most Americans would hold to be a decrease in emissions and an increase in efficiency as an increase, and they use the arcana and the inflexibility of the current rules as a camouflage to hide behind. A word on the reliability of the electrical system. There's a reason why many years before the blackout occurred, we named our organization the Electric Reliability Coordinating Council. John's rather simplistic view of the electric system would have you believe that transmission systems and generation systems fit in neat little boxes. But we know that's not true, and the people of New York know that's not true. When a transmission system goes down, the first thing that happens is between 20 and 40 generation systems on the Eastern Interconnect go down. You have to have those facilities maintained and in tip-top condition before you can bring them easily back up online. We don't know what causes cascading blackouts, and as a result, it is foolish in the extreme to discourage the electric power industry from engaging in routine maintenance activities. John knows that, and that's why I believe the environmental organizations have been relatively silent after the blackout. This is a very serious problem. We estimated alone that efficiency improvements of only 2 to 4% in the industry would be the equivalent of building 20 to 40 new power plants of 300 megawatts apiece with no new emissions. That's what hangs in the balance with respect to efficiency improvements, and it is an important element that keeps the entire system reliable.
We're talking to John Walk, who's director of the Natural Resources Defense Council, and Scott Siegel, who represents utilities in this country, the Electrical Reliability Coordinating Council. So the exemption has been pushed through by the Bush administration. What can you do about it, John Walk, as an organization that is opposed to it?
Well, the Bush administration is trying to sneak this out as early as tomorrow while Congress is out of town and America is on vacation in order to save their nominee to head the EPA, whose confirmation hearings will be coming up next week, from having to deal with this. I mean, if they were proud of this, why would they be trying to jam it out while Congress is out of town and before their new person takes over a mere few months after they adopted this? They
jam it out after 2 years?
They know it is a dirty air rule. The reason that they is because it is completely illegal. My organization, NRDC, joined by numerous other attorneys general from states, including New York, will be filing a lawsuit to block this rule. It is flagrantly illegal, and it is nothing more than a polluter payoff to big coal-fired power plants who cause tens of thousands of deaths across this country every year.
Well, this, as you reported in, at the outset, there's this even just this part of this rule has been actively under consideration for 2 years. Placed in a broader context, reform of the program has been underway since the earliest days of the Clinton administration. And to say that somehow releasing the rule in a timely fashion is somehow dishonest is ridiculous. In fact, this rule is long overdue. It verges on libelous to say that Governor Leavitt, for example, the new head of the EPA, would be anything but comfortable with this rule. And frankly, when they appointed the acting administrator of EPA, the White House said to her, do not be a caretaker. Go ahead and get things done. And that's exactly what she's done in this case. This rule is released today or will be released tomorrow, perhaps, in order to be impactful on the fall maintenance schedule for most facilities. And if you want to make these facilities enhance their pollution prevention and make for safer work environments, which is incidentally why all the major manufacturing unions also support the NSR reform program, then you must proceed forward and release these in a timely fashion. And that's what we're asking for.
Let me ask Scott Siegel, Director of the Electrical Reliability Coordinating Council. Given the latest news, the report of the Environmental Protection Agency that says the White House pressured them to lie about the environment in New York after 9/11, why should people have faith now that the Bush administration is working in the health interests of the American people when it comes to clean air?
Well, this rule is the product of over 8 public hearings, hundreds of thousands of rulemaking comments filed on the record, the input of major organizations, everything from organized labor to, indeed, business organizations, environmental organizations like John's, individual citizens, state-level organizations, and there's been a massive amount, in fact, an abundance of process associated with this rule. Now, I don't know a lot about the 9/11 report that came from EPA. I can only assume that they were under some unique and strict burdens in terms of time and a lot of information to process and under pretty catastrophic conditions. But in this case, we've had years and years of process, every possible and imaginable way of input. And John has even highlighted that the input will continue even after the rules are final by the filing of yet another lawsuit. Please do recall that lawsuits like this that delay the implementation of rules, I don't think particularly give a lot of predictability to industry that particularly the Eastern Interconnect relies upon for its reliable sources of electricity.
I just got to say, I mean, this is Orwellian spin. I mean, you heard Scott earlier say, you know, a pollution increase equals a pollution decrease. The 100
no, that's
thousands
NRDC's
of
position.
Comments that he mentioned were all opposed to these rules. I have documents demonstrating White House interference with EPA's rule in a way that was designed to make it dirtier, in a way that was designed to make it unlawful. The same polluter deception is occurring here as occurred in the September 11th report. We have an EPA now under the Bush administration that stands for every polluter's accomplice and is working contrary to the public health interest of the American public. There is no defensible air quality reason for this rule. And if you will listen carefully, Scott has not denied, because he cannot deny, that this rule will increase pollution. He has talked about everything on this conversation except pollution increases, which by definition will result from this rule.
Now, I have denied that, and our argument is that it increases the efficiency of these facilities, which is the best way to prevent pollution.
We're going to have to leave it there. Scott Siegel, Director of the Electrical Reliability Coordinating Council, and John Walk, who is Director of the Natural Resources Defense Council. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we move to another debate, this in the South, the scene very dramatic yesterday in Montgomery, Alabama, where people turned the courthouse into a campground. A crowd of hundreds rallied for a seventh straight night in support of Chief Justice Roy Moore. In July 2001, without the permission of the other justices, Chief Justice Moore installed a 2-ton Ten Commandments monument in the state Supreme Court. Moore installed The monument was suspended by a state judicial ethics panel last week for disobeying a federal court order to remove it. Supporters of the Ten Commandments monument yesterday filed a last-ditch lawsuit to prevent its apparently imminent removal from the Alabama Judicial Building. The suit was filed in federal court in Mobile, Alabama, on behalf of a Christian radio talk show host and a pastor. It says forced removal of the monument would violate the constitutional guarantee of freedom of religion. Speaking to the crowd, Moore said, quote, "I have acknowledged God as the moral foundation of our law. It is my duty. Should I keep back my opinion at such a time as this, for fear of giving offense, I should consider myself guilty of treason and of an act of disloyalty towards the majesty of heaven." After his 1992 appointment as a circuit court judge, Roy Moore held prayers in his courtroom and adorned a wall with a hand-carved plaque of the Ten Commandments. That prompted an unsuccessful 1994 suit that initiated his steady rise from obscurity to the highest judgeship in the state of Alabama. He rejected requests to include a statue of an Adam or a copy of the Quran, arguing that American law is based on Judeo-Christian beliefs. We're joined right now by Richard Cohen, who's general counsel for the Southern Poverty Law Center, which represents one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit against Moore seeking removal of the Ten Commandments monument, and Brian Chavez Ochoa, who's lead counsel for the plaintiffs who filed a lawsuit yesterday to keep the granite block where it is. He is lead counsel for Operation Rescue West, an anti-abortion group involved in the courthouse protest. Well, why don't we start with Brian Chavez Ochoa? Can you talk about the plaintiff you represent and the reason for keeping the Ten Commandment monument there?
Yes. The two plaintiffs, Kelly McGinley, is a Christian talk show host who resides in Mobile, Alabama. And then our second plaintiff, Pastor Richard Dorley, pastors a local church in Tallahassee, Alabama. And they are asking the court to for an injunction ordering the Ten Commandments monument to remain in the rotunda of the Supreme Court building on the grounds, as you stated earlier, that the removal would be to violate their First and 14th Amendment rights under the United States Constitution.
Well, can you explain what your problem is with this?
Yeah, what we are asserting is that by removal of the monument, that the court has ordered the discrimination against one religion in favor of another religion. What we are arguing is that by removing it, the federal court is ordering that nothing be left in its place, and nothing, in fact, a non-theistic God, a recognized religion, or non-theistic religious beliefs, which is a recognized religion. In doing so, you're discriminating against the Christian Judeo faith, and which, of course, as Mr. Cohen has argued, that discrimination, of course, is impermissible.
Can you explain again why this doesn't violate the separation of church and state?
Well, it's our argument that is foundation of the jurisprudence of our legal system, and that many of our laws that we find ourselves under today are in fact derivative from the Ten Commandments.
So that church and state shouldn't be separated?
No, certainly not. No, what we're saying is that the tradition and the history of the Ten Commandments is that such that you can view it simply in a secular status. But furthermore, by removing it, which is the quandary, places the court in the position, as I said, of having removed one God and replacing it with a false God.
Richard Cohen.
I have a lot of respect for the beliefs of the clients that the gentleman represents. But I think the lawsuit has no more chance of success than did Fox's lawsuit against Al Franken. The courts in Montgomery have said that this is, that the monument is an impermissible promotion of religion. The fact that some people in Mobile would like the monument to stay doesn't immunize it from constitutional challenge. Let me give an analogy. If the mayor of Mobile put a giant crucifix on top of City Hall, that would surely violate the First Amendment. And it wouldn't change the situation if a citizen filed a lawsuit and said, please don't take the crucifix down. It represents something important to me, and you'll be discriminating against my faith to take it down. So, you know, I respect the beliefs of the gentleman's clients, but I've got to say that the lawsuit has absolutely no chance of success.
Right now, what is the intent of the people who are outside the courthouse, the hundreds of people who rallied there? Will they engage in civil disobedience against the removal of the Ten Commandments monument?
Well, let me tell you, I'm across the street from the courthouse now. I'm kind of looking at it, and there will be quite a crowd as the day goes on. I think the truth of the matter is that they're not going to take the monument out of the courthouse. What's going to happen is they're going to move it into, I think, a storage area. That will accomplish three goals. First, it will comply with the court order because the monument will no longer be in a public place. Second, they won't have to run the gauntlet of protesters. And third, should the Chief Justice of Alabama, who wants to take this to the Supreme Court, ultimately prevail there, and I think he has no chance of doing so, but if he does, then the monument will be ready at hand and they can bring it back to the rotunda. So what I think is going to happen is in the next couple days, the monument's going to be moved to a non-public area. There's going to be protest, but once it's gone, I think the protesters will, I think it'll dissipate.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. We have been joined by both the people who have sued against having the Ten Commandments monument at the courthouse and those who don't want it removed. Richard Cohen is general counsel for the Southern Poverty Law Center. Brian Chavez Ochoa, lead counsel for the plaintiff, lead counsel for Operation Rescue West. And you are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to the recall vote in California. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with the program, this news just in, the toll of U.S. troops killed in post-war Iraq surpassed the number killed in major combat, reaching 139 with the death of a U.S. soldier in a roadside bombing just a little while ago. But now we go to California, to the California recall vote. Arnie's father, the Nazi. That was the headline of an article by British journalist and biographer Wendy Lee last March. At the time of the story's publication, Arnold Schwarzenegger was simply Arnold the actor. Today he stands a chance to soon become Arnold the governor, and the story is getting a second life. The latest Los Angeles Times poll has found that California Lieutenant Governor Cruz Bustamante has taken a wide lead over Schwarzenegger. 35% of the voters backing Bustamante. Schwarzenegger stood at 22%. But the poll was taken before Republican Bill Simon dropped out of the race. Simon, who is the Republican gubernatorial nominee last year, was polling at about 6%. So this story. Journalist Wendy Lee reveals that newly found documents show that Arnold Schwarzenegger's father, Gustav, had voluntarily joined the Nazi Party in Austria and was a member of Hitler's notorious brown-shirted stormtroopers, known as the Brown Shirts. Connections between the Schwarzenegger family and the Nazis have been known since the early 90s, when Lee published her book, Arnold, the Unauthorized Biography. Today, Wendy Lee is working on an updated book, and she joins us on the phone from Britain. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Wendy.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be talking to you.
Well, can you tell us what the allegations are and why that in any way taints Arnold Schwarzenegger?
Well, they're not allegations. They are facts that Gustav Schwarzenegger in March of 1938 applied to become a member of the Nazi Party, but that he also was a member of Hitler's Brown Shirt. None of this is actually a reflection on Arnold, but at the time when I made the original allegations, well, your word, not mine, when I found the documents in Berlin, Arnold did everything to stop the American media and indeed any media from reporting them. And I think that is what is disturbing to me, that to go into politics in a country where the First Amendment is the cornerstone of that country, and to do everything you can to circumvent it, as he certainly did in my case, is a bit disturbing.
What did he do to try to stop the information from getting
out? Well, journalists at the Cannes Film Festival, who wanted to interview Arnold about the film Total Recall, this was in 1990, had to sign, before any interview, they had to sign an agreement that they wouldn't ask Arnold about my book or mention it in their articles. And there was a lot more evidence that from other media that Arnold had done all he could to make sure that my book wasn't mentioned.
What about Arnold himself, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and his views on this issue, also going back to his relationship with Kurt Waldheim?
Well, Arnold has done all he can in financial terms to mitigate any fallout from his father's past. I mean, he has donated, since my book was published, he donated large sums of money to the Simon Wiesenthal Institute, and has done all he could to kind of mitigate the fallout.
Now, what do you mean when you say he's given large amounts of money to Simon Wiesenthal Center, which investigates Nazis,
yes,
known as the leading Nazi hunter? So what do they say about his father?
Well, in Los Angeles, they're very enthusiastic about Arnold, and he's been a big supporter of the Institute in L.A.
But what do they say about his father, Gustav Schwarzenegger, and also about his meetings with Kurt Waldheim?
Well, the two separate issues. I mean, they obviously feel, as I do, that Arnold's father is no reflection on Arnold. His past, when the son is not responsible for the crimes of the father. As for the Kurt Waldheim scenario, that's a whole other issue. Kurt Waldheim, at the time of Arnold's 1986 marriage, had been revealed as having played a large part in war crimes in the Balkans. He had, of course, at that point been Director General of the UN, but research by the World Jewish Congress proved that he had, in fact, been involved in war crimes. Arnold, at his wedding to Maria Shriver in April 1986, and Kurt Waldheim at that point, I must make clear, was president of Austria, had sent Arnold a life-size statue of himself and Maria in Austrian traditional lederhosen and costume. And Arnold made a very kind of long, well, not long, but a very vociferous toast, basically saying that he, no matter what the allegations were, he loved Kurt. And later on, he told one of the sources who I interviewed for my book that he felt that Waldheim had been a victim of bad publicity. And he also, at a later date, met with Waldheim in Austria. But that, again, I mean, he's backpedaled very much from that position of being a friend, I guess is probably too strong a word, but of being, I suppose, an advocate of Waldheim. He's definitely backpedaled from all of that.
We're talking to Wendy Lee, who wrote the unauthorized biography of Arnold Schwarzenegger called Arnold. The Jerusalem Post reported that Arnold Schwarzenegger was photographed in 1996 with Horg Haider, the leader of Austria's extreme right-wing Freedom Party. Haider has praised Hitler's, quote, sensible policies and also was filmed at a secret SS reunion.
That's a bit shocking and extremely surprising to me. I actually, my book finishes in 1990, and I'm actually, you know, currently updating, and I hadn't actually, I know nothing about that situation.
Again, that was Haider. Looking at your book, the An Unauthorized Biography, Haider. An unauthorized biography, Arnold.
Yes.
You say it must also be pointed out the second of the... you talk about witnesses over the years who've seen Arnold break into the Sieg Heil salute and play his records of Hitler speeches. And you also have Arnold responding to that.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk more about that?
At this point, I mean, I really feel that we should move on and talk about Arnold now. And I think now... In the past years, I mean, there's total, there's no evidence at all that this was anything but a kind of useful moment or two.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, those sources date back to when Arnold first came to America during times when he was as a bodybuilder, kind of clowning around. I mean, I think that this was something that faded out pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Washington Post recently reported Arnold Schwarzenegger has served for 15 years on the organization U.S. English, which promotes English to be the country's official language. The group also opposes bilingual education. Less known about the organization are the group's ties to right-wing nationalist movements. On the line with us, in addition to Wendy Lee, the unauthorized biographer of Arnold Schwarzenegger, is Mark Potok, editor of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Quarterly Intelligence Report, which monitors far-right hate groups in the United States. Can you talk about this organization that Arnold Schwarzenegger has served on the board of for more than a dozen years?
Yeah, it's an important piece of this puzzle, I think. Arnold Schwarzenegger joined back in 88 the advisory board of U.S. English. Very shortly after that, there was a scandal when memos were leaked, written by the group's founder, John Tanton. The memos said, essentially they made racist statements about Hispanics. They weren't, completely guttural statements, but they were enough to cause, at that time, Walter Cronkite to quit the advisory board of the group, and Linda Chavez, the conservative Republican columnist, to quit as executive director. But Schwarzenegger stayed on. That's, I guess, neither here nor there. That was 15 years ago or thereabouts. But very recently, we found about 3 months ago that U.S. English had just hired a guy named James Lubinskis. Lubinskis is a fellow who is for many years, back to 1998, the assistant editor of something called American Renaissance, which is simply a white supremacist magazine. In addition, Lubinskis has spoken at groups of Klan-like organizations that featured, he's on the dais with David Duke, with a well-known neo-Nazi named Sam Van Rensburg, who was then the membership coordinator of our main neo-Nazi group in the United States, and so on. I am not alleging, because I certainly don't know, that Schwarzenegger had any idea who these people were. I think it's not believable that the people who run U.S. English had no idea who Lubinskas was. He's very well known in racist circles. And really the point is that since this came out, since we told the columnist of the Washington Post the details of what had occurred at U.S. English, David Horowitz, the very conservative fellow who used to be a left-winger, has reportedly left the advisory board as a result. In addition, Lubinskas was either fired or resigned. He left right away after that column appeared with these revelations contained in it. And Schwarzenegger has done nothing. He said nothing about it. He's still up there. If you go on their website today, you will find him on the advisory board, along, I should say, in the interest of fairness, with a number of other sort of celebrities, people like Saul Bellow and Alex Trebek. But that's the story. I think that what U.S. English has shown is they've always been kind of followed by accusations, allegations of racism. And I think the hiring of a few months ago of this fellow Lubinskas tells you something about the group. This is not a mainstream kind of immigration restriction group. I think it's got a nastier agenda underneath.
Well, I'd like to talk about how this is playing out. Lydia Camarillo is on the line with us as well. She's vice president of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project. How does this play with the voters? The big news in California, which isn't news, is the power of the Latino voters in California.
Well, I think that both the whole connection of the U.S. English, which is a sensitive issue for Latinos over the last 20 years. It basically has been an affirmation of a group who refuses to understand that the Latino culture includes being bicultured and bilingual and has aggressively attempted to eliminate those rights of the community. That connection, coupled with the whole connection of Arnold's Prop 187, is sending a chilling message to the Latino electorate. I think that that's why you saw Arnold's numbers dropping so dramatically from being the front runner above all at about 45-49% to now 22, as people are beginning to understand not only his positions but his connections to groups that are outright have attacked and have a history of attacking the Latino community. And so I think that coupled with the fact that now Bustamante, who is a Latino, fought against 187, has stood forth as a Latino, proud to say he's a Latino. And, of course,
and for listeners who around the country who are not as familiar with Prop 187, how would you describe it in a sense?
Well, 187 is what we saw as, in 1994, a proposition that was trying to eliminate the rights of at that time, people thought it was just for against undocumented communities, the right to be educated. It was really an attack on Plyler versus Doe, not allowing children to be educated in public schools and not having the right to have communities to have health education.
Now, Pete Wilson was a big proponent of it. He also is one of the most vocal people, the spokespeople right now for Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Wilson used that as a strategy to win and to garner the conservative right, which is exactly the same strategy that they're using for Arnold. Right now, because there are several Republicans, although Simon dropped out,
we have 10 seconds.
On the race, on the ballot, that are pretty prominent conservatives. They need the conservative right, and so they've decided, Arnold strategist, that the best way is to show the conservative right that conservative arm and that strategy, and then alienate the Latino electorate.
Well, Lydia Camarillo, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Vice President of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, Mark Potok of the Southern Poverty Law Center, Wendy Lee, journalist writing an update to her unauthorized biography called Arnold, speaking to us from London. That does it for the show. If you'd like a copy, 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. I should say we called the Arnold Schwarzenegger campaign, asked for anyone. We also asked the Simon Wiesenthal Center to be on the program. Both did not get back to us. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.